tuned in to APA Compass, a monthly Asian and Pacific American public affairs program. Today, we'll feature interviews with Grace Lee Boggs, as well as author and filmmaker Helly Lee. We will also be joined live by Kalpana Krishnamurthy and Priscilla Huang of the National Asian Pacific American Women's Forum for a discussion on APA women and activism. And as always, we bring you another Angry APA Minute.
Grace Lee Boggs has devoted a lifetime to the struggle for social justice. Born in Rhode Island in 1915, she received her Ph.D. in philosophy from Bryn Mawr in 1940 and worked closely with C.L.R. James during the 1940s and 50s. She is best known for her work in various political movements, including those surrounding labor rights, black power, and environmental justice. She is the co-author of Revolution and Evolution in the 20th Century, co-written with her husband, James Boggs, and Living for Change, her autobiography. She has received numerous awards recognizing her social justice work. At 92, she is still hard at work, having co-founded Detroit Summer, a grassroots organization devoted to rebuilding Detroit from the ground up, and maintaining an active political voice through her numerous lectures, interviews, and via the internet and her work with the Boggs Center to nurture community leadership. She came to Oregon State this past fall to deliver the Ava Helen and Linus Pauling Memorial Lecture on World Peace. I had the opportunity to talk with Grace the day after her lecture. I asked her how her experiences as a child and young woman might have helped shape her political consciousness and set the stage for her work as a lifelong activist.
Well, I need to say that I was not an activist until after I left the university in 1940 and went to Chicago and was on my own. But very early on, because I think of my mother's position, when I realized that she was my father's second wife and that she gave birth to my oldest sister on the floor in steerage coming from China, at the same time that his number one wife was giving birth to my half-brother in China, gave me some insight, I think, into what are the handicaps in being born female. I think that was my first consciousness. And so at the age of 15, I became what I thought was a feminist, which was, of course, far short of what the women's movement would create many years later. But I read Charlotte Perkins Gilman's book, Women and Economics, and I talk about it very often, about how she talked about young women and kids growing up sitting on their father's lap and tickling him under the chin in order to get a new doll or a new dress. And I swore that that was not how I was going to end up. So my consciousness, I think, as a feminist was stronger than my consciousness as an Asian American. I think we're too few and far between in those years. You know, there were only 130,000 Chinese Americans in the U.S. around 1930. So you didn't think of yourself as a minority or as a person with rights in the way that developed, of course, after the black movement began to take hold.
In 1953, she moved to Detroit and married James Boggs, an African-American auto worker, writer, and labor activist. Of her early experiences in Detroit, she recalled,
first of all, the black nationalism only emerged in the decade, in a very powerful way, in the decade of the 60s. Prior to that time, many of the people who came from the South, particularly in the Detroit community, had been used to living really on the next block to white people. And there had been a number of marriages by blacks to Korean women who were here. So there was a certain amount of consciousness of black-Asian relations. And then I often try to explain to people that the history that black and white women have to each other in terms of black women having been the ones who took care of the kids and mopped the floor and washed the dishes and did the laundry and so forth, did not exist between blacks and Asians. There was no history of that kind of, long history of that kind of oppression. So I was, by and large, received very warmly in the black community. In fact, as I say very often, I felt much more at home there than I'd felt in the Caucasian community in which I was raised.
I also asked her what she would view as significant changes in the activist community during her decades of work.
I have today young friends who are Asian American, and their upbringing is very different from mine for a number of reasons. Number one, they have had classes in Asian American studies. They come out of university with a consciousness of their history and of our history in a sense which I never had it. So these kids come out of college with a sensibility that we didn't have in the past. That's number one. Number two, they are growing up in a world where civil rights and having been won through the black movement, they have privileges and opportunities which we never would have dreamed of in the past. The young people that I'm associated with, Asian Americans in Detroit, are very committed to rebuilding Detroit. Many of them have come out of the environmental sciences, out of the environmental justice movement. They're very socially conscious. So it's a very different world. And I'm very happy about that. I mean, I could never, you know, dream that this would happen. It's amazing how it has emerged.
One of the points stressed in Grace's work is the need for self-examination and change among activists themselves, rather than a focus solely on change in terms of those in power. I asked her to elaborate.
I don't know whether I said it last night, but I often feel it and express it, that I'm very lucky to have gone through the Marxist-Leninist period to understand that for a long period, people thought simply in terms of us versus them, and how that led to victims versus villains kind of thinking, and also to the illusion that if we took their place, that somehow they would disappear and we would become perfect angels. And to have had that experience that when you take over the state, you actually become part of the state, on the one hand, to know that, to know how much during the Marxist-Leninist period people thought of the oppressed as masses and didn't think of them as individuals and of how they also could and needed to transform. I mean, to see that ideology, to have experienced it, to have thought that way, is very helpful as you move into a period and you can see the need to transform ourselves, to grasp, to appreciate the concept of two-sided transformation. Because what that does is it begins to, though folks don't realize it, it enables you to put a greater value on yourself than the other kind of thinking. It gives you actually more power to see yourself as mutable, as transformable, as changeable.
Grace Lee Boggs has also been active in grassroots media, and I asked her what she sees as the role or potential of grassroots media for affecting social change.
What I see happening among young people is a kind of peer-to-peer relationship, which is quite different from what you get with the print media. And I am just amazed at what these young people are able to do. They know how to engage each other in devising positive solutions. And there's something inherent in the technology that's different from print technology, which is much more vertical and hierarchical. And if we find ways and means to appreciate and understand that, and find ways to relate intergenerationally, and at the same time accept that we're on the threshold of something very new, we can make a lot of progress. I find myself in my 90s living in this amazing world of change. It's just amazing. I don't know how long I'm going to be doing it, but as long as I'm here, I'm going to be doing it, as long as I have my marbles.
Good morning. You are listening to APA Compass on KBOO 90.7 FM. APA Compass is an Asian Pacific American public affairs program. This is Patty.
And this is Priya.
And we are going to be talking today with Priscilla Huang. Hello, Priscilla.
Hi, good morning.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Of course. Thanks for inviting me.
So Priscilla is here representing, or she's on the phone, representing NAPOF, and can you tell us what that acronym stands for, Priscilla?
Absolutely. So NAPOF stands for the National Asian Pacific American Women's Forum.
And we just want to thank you for being with us, and we were hoping that you could give our listeners a little background on NAPOF, how it started, and how you got involved with it.
Okay. So NAPOF is a national multi-issue Asian and Pacific Islander women's advocacy organization. I know there's a lot in there, but basically what that means is we are membership-based across the country. We have 10 chapters in various cities and college campuses, and we have some evolving chapters also in college campuses and cities. And on the national level, we also engage in policy advocacy. We have a really interesting history. So we actually started by a group of women who were at the Fourth World Conference on Women in Beijing in 1995. And there was an informal caucus that formed of about 50 Asian American activists who pretty much met each other for the first time in Beijing at that conference. And they realized, you know, this is crazy. I can't believe we're on the other side of the world meeting one another for the first time and learning about each other's work. And they vowed when they came back to the States to start a national progressive APA women's movement. And so in 1996, NAPOF had its first founding conference. And officially launched as and continues to be the only national multi-issue Asian American women's organization. So since then, we have been all membership and all volunteer based until 2003, when we were able to hire our first executive director. And beginning in 2003, we've expanded and grown to a staff of seven. With offices in five cities around the country.
Wow. Can you talk a little bit about some of the specific issues that NAPOF is working on right now?
Sure. So, well, when we first started, and we called the women who started NAPOF our founding sisters, when the founding sisters came together, they identified six issue areas and also wrote platform papers on each of these issues, which are available on our website for people to read and review. Those issues are civil rights, economic justice, equal educational access, reproductive justice, ending violence against women, and immigrant and refugee rights. And because we only started to hire full-time staff in 2003, and we're still a relatively small and emerging nonprofit organization, we've prioritized certain issues over the years. The first program area that really developed and evolved for us is around reproductive justice, and we have a pretty, I would say, a broad range of expertise on this issue and a lot of materials also available on our website regarding APA women and their reproductive health and justice. Our second program area that's been evolving over the last year or so is our anti-trafficking program, which is not a formal platform area, but we consider it to be an economic justice issue, which obviously has overlaps with immigrant rights. And we are very excited about that program and are evolving. And then this year, we're also launching another program area on specifically on immigrant rights issues here in the U.S.
Could you speak a little bit more about maybe one or two of these platforms and how they really are significant specifically for Asian Pacific American women? For example, reproductive justice. What are the specific issues that come up for Asian Pacific Islander American women?
Definitely. So, you know, the reason we became involved in reproductive justice issues is because as an organization and as policy advocates, we noticed that there is not a lot of data or health studies devoted to Asian Pacific American women or even included information on Asian and Pacific Islander women. But when we did look at the data that did exist, there were some pretty stark health disparities. So, for example, between the years of, I believe it was 1992 and 2000, Asian and Pacific Islander women had increasing rates of abortion, while other ethnic groups had decreasing rates. Asian and Pacific Islander women continued to have really high abortion rates. They're at the second highest rates right now. We also saw things like, you know, Vietnamese women have the highest rate of cervical cancer among all racial and ethnic groups. Mm-hmm. And we saw disparities also with women who work in certain sectors. For example, we have an entire campaign we're spearheading a coalition devoted to the work to advancing health and worker safety for nail salon workers, mm-hmm. who tend to be immigrant Asian women, and because they're exposed to literally thousands of chemicals in the products that they use, you know, they've experienced all sorts of reproductive harm, and sometimes the children that they give birth to while they're on the job also have some marked developmental delays. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, again, these are issues that disproportionately impact Asian and Pacific Islander women. And API women tend to be and continue to be pretty invisible in the larger reproductive rights movement. And so we felt that it was really important for NAPOF to create the space for API women and really advocate for them and challenge and push the mainstream reproductive rights movement and researchers and policymakers to really include this analysis when they're creating policy.
That's great. We're talking to Priscilla Wong with the National Asian Pacific American Women's Forum. And if you have any questions that you'd like to ask Priscilla, please feel free to call in to KBOO. The number is 503-231-8187. So Priscilla, you mentioned another issue that NAPOF is working on is human trafficking.
Mm-hmm.
Could you talk a little bit about what NAPOF's perspective on trafficking is and how you link that, especially to economic justice issues?
Okay, I can definitely try. I will just put myself out there and say that I'm definitely not the anti-trafficking resident expert, and I have more of a background in reproductive justice. But, you know, our anti-trafficking program is actually pretty unique, I think. The reason that we started to develop this area is because a lot of our members are anti-trafficking advocates in their own communities. And so we started to hear about, you know, some pretty egregious abuses going on. For example, a lot of mail order brides in Seattle who were Filipina were coming into organizations like the Safety Center, and, you know, were describing just really horrible situations where they were being abused by their husbands and just exploited in a lot of different ways. And a from there to New York and D.C., where we were hearing stories of, again, Asian women who were being brought into the U.S. as domestic workers and working for wealthy families or wealthy diplomats, and also being exploited and abused for their labor. So this issue came to our attention through our members. We had a gathering of Asian and Pacific Islander women who are experts in this, and from that we've developed a pretty comprehensive agenda that we will be launching in March, hopefully March, at the latest early April, that looks at the human trafficking, looks at human trafficking in the United States through an Asian and Pacific Islander women's perspective. So what's included in that is a critique of the mainstream human trafficking movement, mm-hmm. which has really focused on sex trafficking over the years. Mm-hmm. I think I would venture to say that most, you know, your average American has heard about trafficking, but they immediately associate it with sex trafficking.
Definitely.
Because that's all that the administration, that's all that mainstream women's rights movement, and that's all that most of our federal policies have really focused on. And our theory behind that is, the government has become involved because after the collapse of the Soviet Union, a lot of Eastern European women started to be trafficked into sex work. And there's been a history of mainstream feminists really focusing on liberating, quote-unquote, white women from this experience, when the statistics really show that Asian women are represent the ethnic group that's really most affected by human trafficking. They represent the most, the largest proportion of survivors in the U.S., you know, both in sex trafficking, but also in other forms of human trafficking, such as domestic servitude or sweatshop labor and those types of industries.
Mm-hmm. What kind of relationship has NAPOF had around this issue with mainstream feminist organizations?
It's been challenging. I mean, you know, we are a women's organization, and we all, at heart, I think, identify as feminists, even if we, and feminist ideals, even if we might not call ourselves feminists. And, of course, we really appreciate and honor, you know, the history of feminists in the past and what they've done for women throughout the United States. But these are also mainstream feminist organizations are also pretty well established. You know, they've been around a lot longer than we have. They represent a demographic that holds a lot of power, mm-hmm. Both in D.C. and throughout the country. They tend to be middle class, and our relationship with them has been good in the sense that, you know, when we have challenged some of the groups in the past, they have asked us to join their table. We've had to do a lot of asking, but I would say in recent years we've been invited more times than we've had to ask, so I think that's a great sign that a lot of these women's groups are starting to recognize the role that women of color have in influencing policy for all women. But it certainly hasn't come easy.
So you're listening to APA Compass. We're talking to Priscilla Huang with the National Asian Pacific American Women's Forum. And if you have a question for Priscilla, do call in. The number is 503-231-8187. So Priscilla, can we turn to the question of immigration? I know you mentioned that this is another issue that NAPOF is working on, and it's certainly an issue that is emerging as really significant, both with new federal legislation and in the presidential elections.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk a little bit about what some of the specific approaches to the question of immigration NAPOF has taken, and how, especially because immigration is often not framed as a feminist issue,
mm-hmm.
how NAPOF sort of think specifically about the impacts of changes in immigration policy on women?
Sure. So as I mentioned, this is a new program area for us, and we haven't officially launched it, but we've certainly been thinking a lot about immigration issues as they affect API women, and starting to develop some theories around it. I mean, I think you're certainly right to characterize the immigrant rights movement and immigration issues in general as something that's not traditionally thought about through a feminist lens, and we are trying to challenge that. We have actually co-convened a national coalition of reproductive rights, women's rights, and immigrant rights groups to really promote and encourage the immigrant rights movement to insert a gender lens into the movement. And through that, we've looked at things like the DREAM Act, for example, which is a bill that would allow a pathway to citizenship for children who entered the country undocumented and have pretty much grown up in the U.S. but cannot enter college or just can't become citizens because they're undocumented. And this bill has had a lot of support. In the past, it's had a lot of bipartisan support, but it's also had a lot of support in the immigrant rights movement. But the interesting thing about it is, you know, there are two pathways that the DREAM Act provides. One is through education. So the undocumented student could, if they fulfill the 2 years of college, they could be eligible for citizenship. The other pathway, though, is something that we found kind of problematic. That pathway encourages undocumented youth to join the military and to serve for at least 2 years in order to become eligible. And the issue that arose for us, and I think this is because, you know, as feminists, we have a different perspective, was what would happen to an undocumented young woman in the military when we've heard so many stories about sexual harassment and abuse, and even, you know, more recently there have been some fairly high profile murders. You know, already I think women in the military face a number of challenges, since it is a very sexist and patriarchal organization and structure. But if you add on top of that your questionable immigration status, you know, women in the military who are undocumented would most likely be exploited and face a number of challenges, including, you know, not reporting any abuses that they might face. And so we raised that issue with the other immigrant rights groups and had some mixed reactions. But I think that's really our role in this movement, is to identify bills and provide that critique through a gender analysis.
Mm-hmm. Could you speak about some of those challenges or obstacles that you faced building coalitions and working on an issue like this?
Yeah. Well, one challenge that, you know, will continue to be an effort to push back against, I think, is that the immigrant rights movement is highly influenced by faith-based organizations who have done a wonderful job advocating for poverty issues and advocating for the human rights of immigrants and for their dignity. However, these are also organizations that are anti-choice. You know, they do not believe or support reproductive health rights and justice issues. And as an organization that does a lot of work on these issues and really believes and promotes them, you know, it becomes challenging to work in coalition with other groups that, you know, are adamantly opposed to these. And I think this is the effect of this tension really comes to light when we're talking about immigrant women's health issues. So there's, right now, immigrants are barred from accessing Medicaid and other federal programs for 5 years after they enter the country through a restrictive bill that was passed in 1996. And it hasn't really, this issue hasn't really sparked a lot of activism from most faith-based groups, I would say almost all of them. And I think one of the reasons for that is because, you know, a lot of women, pregnant women, young women who are immigrants tend to be of reproductive age and really need to access reproductive health services. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, this is not an issue that they prioritize. And so I think the role of NAPOF and other women of color and women's rights issue groups who believe in reproductive rights and health really have to step in and promote and elevate this issue.
I think that's such a great point that you're making. And a lot of the contemporary immigration discourse, it seems like we talk a lot about like whether or not people have a right to be here, but there are also these questions around like who has access to what kinds of social services that don't seem to like some of the questions that you're talking about, like about Medicaid or who should be able to access healthcare or welfare services, don't seem to get as much attention from the immigrant rights movement. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about some of those issues and how they affect APA immigrant women.
Yeah, sure. So, like I mentioned, there's this. There was this law. There are actually two laws that were passed in 1996. One of them is the what's popularly known as the welfare reform law. Excuse me, that was passed by Clinton. And another one that it interacts with is the illegal immigrant. And I don't remember the full name. It's a really long name that doesn't really matter. But the point of it is, in 1996, you know, the government passed these restrictive laws that created a lot of barriers for immigrant women. One, I think the most pressing and immediate outcome of that is that five-year bar that I shared with you, and that's regardless of you know, immigration status. And I should also note that, you know, undocumented immigrant women have never been eligible for social service programs except for emergency Medicaid, and so a lot of public benefit measures in 1996 and beyond, even more recently, they often reiterate this bar, and they meaning policymakers who believe they need to restrict immigrants from accessing public benefits, they continue to emphasize in the media that the reason they're passing these laws is so that undocumented immigrants can't access them, when in fact they never could. So I just wanted to clarify that. But going back to the five-year bar, it's been really problematic because I think I'll use my family as an example. My parents are immigrants. I was born here the year after they arrived, and, you know, it was difficult being a new immigrant to a new country. It takes a lot of time to establish yourself and to, you know, learn the language and the culture and just survive. And so creating a five-year bar to accessing a lot of these public benefits that are intended to, you know, at the core, these programs are intended to help low-income people. And so for the government to bar immigrants from that category in the first 5 years that they're here is just incredibly harsh. And there are also existing sponsor and liability laws that you know, immigrants are required to, for example, if they come through a family-based visa, they're supposed to have a family sponsor here in the States who can basically pledge that they will support this person so that they don't become a public charge, is what it's called.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they there are already a lot of safety nets in place, but when these don't work and you're barred from accessing anything else, then survival becomes very difficult and very real.
If you are just joining us, this is APA Compass, an Asian Pacific American Public Affairs Program, and we are on the phone with Priscilla Huang of NAPOF, the National Asian Pacific American Women's Forum. Priscilla, you've talked a lot about some really important issues, and I was just hoping that we could come back to why it's really important to have a distinct Asian Pacific American women's perspective on some of these issues like immigration and reproductive justice and trafficking.
So one thing that I think...
So I think we've just lost our connection with Priscilla. We are trying to get her back on the phone. But she raised a number of really important issues, including immigration, reproductive justice, the issue of anti-trafficking. She also talked about equal educational access and challenging forms of violence against Asian Pacific American women.
So we're just going to try and get her back on the line right now. Later this morning on KBOO, we have at 10, Scott Forrester interviews Patrice McDermott about her book, Who Needs to Know? The State of Public Access to Federal Government Information. At 10:30 on Sounds of Awareness, Paul Van Dyke interviews educator Dr. James Blue Bickford, the director of Project Braille. And at 11, it's Democracy Now. So I think we have Priscilla back on the line.
Hi.
Hi, I'm sorry that we lost you.
That's okay. That's totally fine. Can you repeat the question? I can start over.
Sure. We were just hoping that you could say a little bit more about why it's so crucial to have a distinct Asian Pacific Islander American women's perspective on some of these issues.
Okay. Thank you. So I'm not quite sure when I got cut off, but I was describing this little tagline rally cry that we use, which is we call each other fierce sisters within the organization. And I think the reason we do that is because as Asian and Pacific Islander American women, there are a lot of stereotypes out there that we have to confront and challenge. I think a big one is around visibility, you know, both demographically and as API women. You know, there's a myth out there that Asian women are passive, you know, Asians don't rock the boat. You know, I think a lot of these familiar stereotypes that I think as a population sometimes we internalize, but definitely from the outside, you know, other populations might view us this way. And so we come together to create a progressive and unified API, a voice to really, you know, make some noise and, you know, piss people off and really say what we believe in. And because we have this sisterhood, we know that we're backed by, you know, hundreds and thousands of other women who support us and believe in us. And, you know, there's power behind that, which is, I think, another issue that we, another stereotype that we also confront. You know, Asian and Pacific Islanders are often seen as the model minority, and I'm sure everyone's familiar with that myth, where it's perceived that Asians are, you know, professionally, educationally, and economically well off, and they, you know, and we've experienced this a few times ourselves, where folks who are new to NAPOF will or have heard about us for the first time will ask, you know, why. Why is there an national API women's organization? You know, aren't you guys doing great? You know, are you a professional organization? Like, they don't really understand what sort of social justice issues we could possibly be working on. So, again, I think it's so important to have an organization like NAPOF who, you know, where we can draw strength and power from within our sisterhood. You know, we're all around the country. In pretty much most major cities, I know there's a NAPOF member there who's willing to back me up and provide housing and just be with me when I'm, you know, on the front lines, for example, or meeting with policymakers. You know, there's this fierceness and there's this sisterhood that we all really tap into.
Well, unfortunately, we're almost out of time. Thank you so much for joining us, Priscilla.
Thank you.
Is there a website that people can go to get more information?
Yes. Our website is www.napawf.org. That's NAPAWF.org. And there's a lot of information about how to become a member, you know, where our chapters are right now, who to contact, and also a lot of research and writing and all sorts of, you know, handouts that you can print and read and to learn about our work.
Great. Thank you so much for joining us. I was Priscilla Hung with the National Asian Pacific American Women's Forum.
Great. Thank you.
In her first book, Korean-American author Helly Lee takes us on a journey discovering her family's legacy told through the triumphant stories of her grandmother. This journey would ultimately result in a mission rescuing some of her family members from North Korea. APA Compass had a chance to catch up with Helly Lee to talk about her books, some of her other projects, and how these experiences have helped her rediscover and appreciate her own identity as a Korean-American woman.
My name is Helly Lee. I'm Korean-American. I'm actually an author. I wrote two books called Still Life with Rice, which was my first book, and that came out in 1996. And my second one, In the Absence of Sun, which came out in 2002. And they're both stories about my family, rediscovering my identity, legacy. I'm really proud of my first book. It's called Still Life with Rice. It came out in 1996. It's a story of my grandmother's life. She was born in 1910, and it's a saga that takes us all the way through to when she becomes 80 years old. And it's about her life pre-post-Korean War. And because it's about a woman's struggle and trying to keep her family together, trying to keep her children alive and her country intact, a lot of people could relate to this. Anything about mothers and grandmothers is a very universal subject that is endearing to people. For me, Still Life was all about discovering my past, so that I better understand, better appreciate who I am and where I come from, because I grew up in a predominantly white neighborhood. I was cut off from my culture. And at that time, when I was growing up in the 70s and 80s, there weren't a lot of Asian Americans or Korean Americans. So we were just basically told to really assimilate it as quickly as possible. And that worked for me until I actually got a little bit older after I graduated from college, and I realized I didn't know who I was or where I belong in this country. And so thus began my journey into discovering who I am. And through the stories of my grandmother and my parents, I came to an understanding and appreciation of the culture that I had rejected and run away from for so many years. After Still Life, I came out with a second book, which is kind of the sequel to Still Life, called In the Absence of Sun. And it tells a story, the real life story of my grandmother's loss of her child when he was 16 years old during the Korean War. We really thought he had been captured or murdered during the war, and that was that. But 41 years later, after the Korean War, my grandmother discovered that he was alive and trapped in North Korea. And thus began this long odyssey of trying to make contact with him. We went through unofficial channels, and we ended up plotting this rescue mission to rescue my grandmother's long-lost son from North Korea. And this was in 1997. What we thought was going to be a 2 to 4 week easy mission turned out to be a 7 month long odyssey. But we were successful. So we ended up finding him. But not only did we end up finding him, we ended up rescuing him and 8 members of his family from North Korea.
In Still Life with Rice, the story of your grandmother's journey, we see her success as a result of her strength, wit, and perseverance. This is quite a contrast to many of the mainstream media images we often see of Asian women being submissive and exotic. How did this journey for you impact your perspective of the women in your family and the roles of Asian women in general?
Growing up, I believed those stereotypes. I believed within my family that the women were really not as strong, independent, self-sufficient as the men. But as I went back to Korea and I started researching about my family, and then when I came back, I was able to see more clearly, and I thought, wow, the women of my family are really intensely strong. They're, without them, our family line would not exist. Our family unity, our family success would not exist. And I think that's no secret within Asian families, that the women are the backbones. But politically, economically, we still, there's a lot of division between men and women.
Speaking of gender roles, after your rescue mission, you did an interesting project, Macho Like Me. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about the project and what you learned from that experience?
I did this project called Macho Like Me. I wasn't sure what I was going to do with it once I finished, but when I came back from the rescue mission in China and rescuing my uncle and his family, and I was very, my participation was very intricate in that whole, the success of it, I believe. But when I was sent to China to work with translators, guides, they were all male. And because I was not married and I was in my 30s, I constantly felt disrespected and disregarded by the men. They told me to behave, be a good girl, and let the men handle everything. And being educated in America, you know, I wasn't going to put up with that. I was like, who are you talking to? And so when I came back to the States after the rescue mission, I was really dumbfounded and stressed out and depressed. And I thought, gosh, if I had been born a son, people would have listened to me in Asia for sure. And then I started thinking about my family and the inequalities that sometimes I see between the men and the women, not because they earned it, but because the men were born with a body part that I was not, simply because of that. So I cut my hair, changed my clothes into men's clothes, and I moved out of my home where everybody knew me as Heli Lee, as a female, and took on this alter identity. And I became Harry Lee for 6.5 months, and I lived as a man 24/7. It was such a high to be able to do that. I was loving it. I loved being that guy at first. But as the journey continued, I realized it's not all that I thought it was going to be. And at the end of 6 months, I realized that I had been actually wrong. And for me to admit that I'm wrong is quite a feat. But I had to admit that I was wrong, that I had misjudged men, that they have it a lot harder than I gave them credit for. It's quite stressful being a man, and I didn't enjoy the experience at all. But I came out more wise, more humble, and more appreciative of men.
Anything about your perspective on Asian American men in particular? Because here, you know, we see in the media there's a loss of masculinity unless they're doing kung fu. Your experience, did it change your perception of that? Or
there are many privileges and advantages that I never counted, that I used and abused but never qualified it as privileges of being a female. Men, not only in the Asian society, but in every society, have a tremendous responsibility to be the carriers of the last name, to be the leaders of the family, to be gladiators, to be soldiers, to be so many things. Even though stereotypes are, you know, we shouldn't really take much, we shouldn't give it much credit, but in the Asian American male stereotype, it's really bad. What is he, Hop Sing? On Bonanza, and what's his name, Lee Dong Duck or whatever, on 16 Candles. So this is what the Asian man has to look forward to, and or computer nerds. It's not a very flattering stereotype.
Is there an overall message for young Asian Americans?
When I was growing up in this country, it was not cool being us. It was not cool being Asian, because they called us Oriental back then. We all know Oriental means oppression, food, rugs. It does not refer to people, but it is cool being us. It's cool having an accent and looking different, and having straight black hair and almond-shaped eyes. It's great because they used to say slanted eyes, but now they're almond-shaped. So it's good being us. So use our difference, our smarts, our sassiness, our education, our strength in our family and our culture to stand out in this country, to tell your story, so not so much for yourself, but the next generation, your children, your grandchildren. The greatest gift that you can ever give them is an understanding of who you are and their legacy.
I'm an actor, and my interest in live theater is an extension of my genuine investigation of who I am and who I can be. That each role contains, in and of itself, the possibility of who I am as a person, as an Asian, as an American, as a Filipino. I take the possibilities of being an actor as a presumption. This encompasses the truthful and the good equally as the perverse and the negative. In this life, it's too easy to forget the importance of understanding how closely those extremes are interrelated. Right now, I'm playing the Emperor of Japan, the Meiji Emperor. This is a very controversial and wrought figure from the late 19th century who represents the meeting point between Western and Japanese influences at that period in history. It's very complicated. I'm very conflicted about it. As someone of a Filipino heritage, the Japanese were held in something of contempt and fear for most of my childhood. I'm at a place now where I can see past those prejudices. But I also know that, well, there are family stories of Japanese beheading uncles and grandparents and depredations on villages where my family fled from. I don't know what to do with all of that. I think that's what this country is all about. And I think that's what the play I'm working on is about as well. So here I am, an actor, investigating the Emperor of Japan. My name is Paul Soucy, and I am speaking for the Angry APA Minute.
The Angry APA Minute is an opportunity for members of our community to sound off on a topic of their choosing. The views expressed do not necessarily reflect those of the APA Compass Collective or CABU.
This is the APA Compass Community Calendar for February 2008. Lee Young Lee, author of 5 volumes of poetry, will be giving a reading at the Newmark Theater, located at 1111 Southwest Broadway, on Wednesday, February 20th at 7:30 p.m. For ticket information, go to www.literary-arts.org or call 503-227-2583. The play, A Few Stout Individuals, will be at Theater through February 17th. Theater is located at 3430 Southeast Belmont. For more information, call 503-242-0080 or visit www.profiletheater.org. Thanks. APA Compass is a collectively produced program. We'd like to thank our guests, Grace Lee Boggs, Kalpana Krishnamurthy, Priscilla Huang, Heli Lee, and Paul Soucy. If you have any comments or suggestions, you can contact us at apacompass@gmail.com.